Welcome to the DJE Podcast, where you will learn about real estate investing from real life examples. Here's your host, Devin Elder.
Hey there, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today. My guest is Jonathan Twombly, and he is an attorney that left Wall Street in 2011 to go full-time into real estate. And he's done a lot of multifamily deals since then. He's been a JV'd or co-GP on about $250 million of multifamily real estate. And then we spent a lot of time in this podcast talking about the value add hotel space. So that's a pretty interesting space. But we also spent time talking about how he got his first few investors, how he kind of went about that backwards, and then ended up building something more long-term in terms of growing an investor list and building those relationships. So we spent some time talking about that, some of the trials and tribulations of doing large multifamily deals with partners. He kind of went right into the large multifamily space, didn't, and skipped all the single family stuff that a lot of us start in. So Jonathan's a sharp guy, former attorney, has done a great job with a portfolio over, for a while now, since 2011. So it's great to get his perspective on where the market's been. And then we spent a little time at the end of the show talking about kind of what he's seen out there and what he expects for the future, the near future for commercial real estate. So hope you enjoy this interview with Jonathan. This episode is brought to you by DJE Texas Management Group, a San Antonio, Texas-based real estate investment firm with a track record of transacting on several $100 million of multifamily land and industrial deals throughout Texas. DJE's been in business for over a decade and is approaching 100 team members in San Antonio. To learn more about DJE, visit djetexas.com or the link in the show notes of this episode. This episode is also brought to you by apartmenteducators.com. A complete ecosystem for professionals to learn how to find, finance, and operate large multifamily properties for profit. You can get started with a free mini course and learn more at apartmenteducators.com or visit the link in the notes. Jonathan, welcome to the show. It's great to have you. How are you, sir?
I'm great. It's great to finally meet you after all this time. So glad to be on the show.
Yeah. We all kind of have these real lives that we lead, and then these digital lives where we kind of connect on social, and obviously we know a lot of the same folks and have been in the business a little while. So great to have you on here. Look forward to diving in. For those folks that are not familiar with you, and I guess for me too, I'm always interested to hear what people's on-ramp was to this commercial real estate world. I know you're an attorney and have some other experiences in your background prior to real estate, but love to hear what got you turned on to real estate and into this business.
So let's see. I mean, like a lot of people, I think I'd always been interested in real estate in some way or another, my dad was actually an architectural historian. So I spent a lot of time as a kid just going around looking at buildings with my dad, and then helped my dad restore his 1810 farmhouse that he lived in.
Cool.
So, kind of always had buildings in my blood, but didn't do anything about it professionally. And like you said, I was a lawyer. I practiced law on Wall Street for more than a decade. And the last part of that was doing real estate related law. So I was actually a litigator. So I saw deals when they fell apart.
Yeah.
And, saw the partnerships when they fell apart, and got my exposure to it that way. But, after practicing law for a while, I really wasn't happy with it. Really wanted to break into some kind of investment field. I wasn't really sure whether it would be real estate or equities. But it wound up being real estate for kind of a variety of reasons. But to make a really long story short, I'd been practicing law for a long time, wasn't happy. Got to a point in my career where, this is right after the financial crisis, the work dried up, and I kind of knew, they hadn't said anything at the firm, but I kind of knew that they were getting ready to fire me, because I was just, sitting around making like $300,000 a year and not doing anything.
Right.
And I knew that this wasn't going to last, but I also wasn't interested in it lasting. I had tried to quit before, and they would talk me out of quitting, but I kind of knew that this time probably was going to wind up with me out of a job. And I started doing a lot of networking to try to break into real estate, wound up meeting somebody who was putting together a syndication business. I had no idea what that was. I sort of jumped into it after I did get terminated. And that was kind of how I broke into the business. That partnership didn't ultimately work out, but it kind of got, I got my feet wet and started, you know, talking to investors, brought investors in, learned how to underwrite deals. You know, so I kind of got my education in that partnership. And then after that, went out on my own.
Yeah, I love it. That's a great on-ramp. I appreciate you sharing that. Was there a phase of buying single family, smaller projects, or you just kind of went right into the commercial syndication stuff?
I never did that smaller property thing. And I kind of wish I had, but because I think it's a great education to do that and kind of like really get your hands dirty, like in property. And I sort of missed out on that stage. I guess, you know, for lack of a better term, I've always been on the finance side of things,
right?
Not so much on the actual like nitty gritty, getting my hands dirty with the property kind of thing. So when I came into the syndication business, and like I said, I didn't know what syndication was, but my first partner, you know, she had like a lot of experience with actual property. And she's like, I want to partner with you because I think you can raise money. And I was like, really? I don't know if I can raise money. But she kind of like, that's what the role that she had me slotted into. And I sort of just, you know, went at it, I guess. But we started out, you know, in that partnership, we were looking at these larger deals down in Louisiana. And I remember the first day of work, you know, when I went to work with her, and I just had assumed for whatever reason, because I'm here in New York City, you know, the conversation here was always, you know, basically like you buy a brownstone and wait for gentrification to happen, and that's how you make money. Right. And I just sort of assumed that that's what we were going to be doing. And she was like, oh, no, we're going to be buying 100 unit properties in Texas and Louisiana. And I was like, how on earth are we going to buy 100 units? Like, that just seemed insane to me. And then at least in those days, I looked at the prices of the stuff and was like, oh, 100 units in Louisiana costs what a brownstone in Brooklyn costs.
I bet.
So, you know, so we started, that's how we started. And I guess I was always in that, that's kind of my entry point was there. So I just kept going with that kind of property.
That's great. I think there's arguments to be made for both tracks. I went the opposite route, did, you know, too many single family houses, hundreds, but and there was learning there, you know, there's lots of lessons along the way, but a lot, it's, I kind of describe it as two different tracks. You've got two different train tracks, and doing a lot of work on one train track doesn't necessarily push you down, you know, further on the other one. So, again, no right or wrong, and the grass is always greener, right? Whatever path we didn't take, you wonder about it. But, yeah, I think it's great. And it's possible, not for everybody, but with, you know, for people that have the business acumen, the financial wherewithal, or kind of have done something else, you know, that's been difficult and requires certain level of wherewithal, it can be done. So that's interesting. So what was that like? Kind of, you had your time back fully to invest in this business. You had decided what asset class you're going to go after. You'd had a partnership. You mentioned that didn't work out or didn't turn into a long-term thing, but what did the rest of the business, what did your trajectory look like kind of after that first partnership?
So, I mean, I struggled to really break through, I guess, right? You know, even though I had capital lined up, you know, we went with that first partnership, we took a couple of deals almost to closing and then didn't close because we had banks back out. You know, we actually lost our lender on those deals.
Oh, wow. What time frame was this?
So this was like 2012.
Okay.
And banks were still pretty skittish after the financial crisis. And they were doubly skittish when we said, oh, yeah, we're going to be buying like C deals in Louisiana. And they were like, we're not so sure. Right. So we had a lender. We had two deals under contract, same seller. And we had the money lined up. And the bank lined up, and then the bank backed out on us in the last minute. So that was a pretty painful experience to go through. That after that, we broke up. I switched my focus to the Carolinas because I was interested in that market. It's a lot closer to New York. It was easier for me to get to than you know, Houma, Louisiana, and these other places that we were looking. And it took me about a year before I was actually able to get brokers to kind of pay attention to me and show me real deals. You know, I was getting all of the junk, the stuff that had been hanging on the market for a long time that was overpriced, like, you know, nothing that really made any sense, until I finally was able to kind of break through with a broker through a personal connection and bought my first deal. And then it was pretty rapid after that, you know, sort of bought four deals pretty quickly. It's kind of how I got started.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting that you had kind of the capital lined up and the financial wherewithal, and it still took that period of time. And I suppose that's anything, right, that you're trying to gain mastery of. The beginning is just brutal and a lot of work and no results. And then you reach some sort of tipping point and do four deals. And it just seems like that's a pattern that plays out in, not just in this game, but in a lot of areas of life.
Yeah. I mean, it's very hard to break through on that first one, because people don't take it seriously.
Sure.
It was like a new market. And it was a different time too. I mean, and maybe we're going to go back to a time like that now, given the way the world is, but
sure.
You know, after the financial crisis, and even in 2013, and so you're talking a few years later, there was just a lot of distrust in the market. And I remember once we got that first deal under contract, I started talking to banks in South Carolina, and they were like, well, you know, you're from out of state, so we're not going to lend to you. Like, you know, wow. would you buy a condo? If you buy a condo here, we'll lend to you. But, you know, and it was because they had been burned by out-of-state investors. I mean, it's funny. I don't mean to sidetrack conversation, but it's just a funny story. Like, there was so I was looking at all these deals, and I kept on seeing the same name in the chain of title of every deal. So you get on, like, not CoStar, another one of those vendors at the time.
Right.
And they would have like all the previous owners of the property, and I kept on seeing the same owner, and it was always this owner and then the sale for zero, right? So they've been foreclosed on. And apparently what happened was there was this one group out of New York City that had gone down to South Carolina, bought a ton of property to rehab it, and they went belly up in the GFC, and they just handed the keys back on like 1,000 or more units, probably more than that.
Yeah.
So all the local banks were just like, oh, you're from out of state, we're not lending, you know, go find someone else, go find another sucker. And, so we had to overcome that as well. And in those days too, I mean, we couldn't get agency financing because we didn't have a track record.
Right.
So we had to do CMBS financing. That was like a whole different thing. So yeah, there was a lot of friction to overcome in those days that I don't think, certainly by the end of the decade, wasn't there. I was always surprised to see these people come out of nowhere and suddenly they're buying all this property. And it's like, what, you guys don't have a track record. You've never done this before. Now you're buying these like $50 million properties. Like, what's going on? I couldn't figure that out. But
What a change in the sentiment. I had lunch with the banker the other day, and he was telling me, he came in the office and he sat down and he said, hey, I'm just going to kind of open the conversation with, we are not going to do deals in this market in Texas. And I just he told the story of sitting down with his loan committee and the bank, you know, owners of the bank, and they had gotten burned in this market in like the 90s on a deal. And he's like, these old guys are like elephants, man. They never forget. It doesn't matter what's happened since then. Strength. Oh, he was bringing a deal that was like this just teed up slam dunk retail deal that this loan officer was like, oh, this is going to be, you know, and they just shot him down cold because they decided they didn't like that market. And that was the end of that. And so these guys have long memories. That's just interesting. And so how did you end up overcoming that to get into to the Carolinas at some
point? So, I mean, like I said, I got the first I solved the broker piece. I mean, I had the equity piece solved already because I already had my investors who were, you know, looking to do deals.
Yep.
Got the broker piece solved through the personal connection. On the first deal for the lending, so we went through one of my investors through his banking relationship with JP Morgan and did a CMBS deal through them. And just the same as with, you know, everything else, like we did the first deal, CMBS, and then after that, it was like, you know, on the second deal, then I went to a mortgage broker because I figured out that that made more sense than trying to go through JP Morgan. Went to a mortgage broker and then was like, oh, okay, you've done one of these before. It just sort of greased the skids a whole lot. And then after that, it wasn't really an issue, getting the debt. So, but you know, like you said, it's sort of once you break the ice, it just becomes a whole lot easier because now nobody wants to take a chance on your first deal.
Right? For sure.
But once you've got one, then it's like, okay, you're a proven commodity. So yeah, makes a big difference. Yeah,
it's a conundrum, you know, whether you're raising capital or getting a loan on one of these big deals, it's like, you just have to figure out a way to go from zero to one, and things change a lot. How were your initial investor relationships and conversations, and, you know, kind of, we talk about borrowing credibility and building a team and things like that, but it's a whole lot easier to raise capital for your fourth deal. The first one, you know, is tough. Were these a lot of kind of professional relationships you had from being an attorney from Wall Street, or how did you go about kind of building that first group of investors?
Yeah. Everything I've done has been kind of backwards, right? So okay. It was the first investors were the easiest for me because they were personal friends,
sure,
who
sure.
kind of like encouraged me to go into the business, right? They were, okay. There were always both of these two different guys. I mean, ultimately I introduced them to each other, but they didn't know each other, but both from kind of different angles, both of them had been pushing me for a long time. Like, hey, someday I want to do business with you. Like someday, whatever. Both, you know, very affluent guys. And, they had said to me when I first started contemplating going into business with my original partner, they had both said, hey, you know, if you do this, we'll give you money to invest. And so it was substantial money. It wasn't like, you know, 50K. It was like, right. I could do a deal with one of these guys' money. Right. Yep. So that helped a lot. And I know most people are not in that position. So I was very fortunate that I was in that position, but it came back to kind of haunt me later because like I relied on those guys too much and right. didn't go and kind of develop an investor base independent of them. I had like a trick, you know, I had like a smattering of other investors, but not really enough to do deals on my own. And I got really complacent. And so I actually had a deal teed up. And it's really funny because this deal, just saw this deal come back on the market. But I had a deal teed up. It was like from a seller we'd already bought from, right near a property I owned. It was really nice. Clean, smooth deal, and went to my guys and they were both out. And because it was, one of them was like, I'm getting divorced. I can't spend any money right now. The other one was in Japan. He's like, look, when the yen was 90 to the dollar, I would buy any deal you put in front of me, I wanted. Now that it's like 120, it's not as interesting to me. So I'm out. And so here I was with this great deal and I was like, I don't have anybody to invest in this deal. You know, I went and tried to like pound the pavement, find people to invest. And it's, let my money go hard to like buy extra time, and ultimately couldn't close the deal because I just didn't have enough extra, you know, firepower outside of those two guys. So that was kind of a really bad experience, but it forced me then to go and figure out how to find investors.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It's kind of like this private equity, pref equity, whatever you want to call it, big check writers on deals. Seems appealing. You know, you're doing a $4 million capital raise. Sure would be nice if $3 million of that was one check, but that check leaves you at the 1 yard line with hard money. You know, you're scrambling. So there's trade-offs there. And also interesting too, I just been my experience 1,000 times where you get your teeth kicked in and then you've got to do something new. And that's how you kind of grow the business through those painful experiences, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you really only grow through those painful experiences. You don't really want to go through it, but it's very easy to get complacent. If you have something that's working, why change it? Right.
Right.
And I always knew like in the back of my mind, like, well, I need to go find some other investors, but it was hard and I didn't know how. And I had a few early conversations that were like kind of went really badly and I didn't want to repeat that again. So I was like, okay, I got my guys, I'll be fine. And I really didn't expect that they were going to, you know, A, both drop out and B, both drop out at the same time.
Right.
And, but like I said, it did then force me to figure out, okay, well, how do I find investors? And like, what do I say to them? And how do I get them onto my list? And, you know, so I did then solve that problem.
That is interesting. I see what you mean by saying, you know, you kind of did it backwards. You're fortunate to have those relationships, which is great. It's not a bad thing. And then later were developed kind of the way a lot of us have this kind of organic thing where you grow a larger investor base. And so what did that look like for you? Was it setting up content? Was it conferences and meetings and putting people on an email list? Or how did you go about building that almost kind of from scratch, right, at that point or close to it?
Yeah. So the way that I did it, it's funny. It wasn't really a plan per se. Well, the way that it worked out, but it worked out pretty well. So I hired somebody. I was like, look, I need help with marketing. I don't know what I'm going to do. So I hired this person who was like a Facebook person. And she said, you got to start a Facebook group, right? And so I was like, okay, I'll start a Facebook group. I didn't really expect it to amount to anything, but I started this Facebook group. And at the time, there were really no other multifamily Facebook groups, right?
Oh, well,
there were a couple. So this is probably about 2015, 2016.
Yep.
And I mean, there were a couple of groups, but they were all very low quality. They were basically just people throwing deals into a group. Sure. Like into a black, like this Echo, whatever, yep. And just pitch a deal in here. And it was a lot of like wholesalers and stuff,
yep.
And nobody really providing any value. And what I started doing was just having conversations in the Facebook group and posting just a lot of, well, I wouldn't say it's like content in the sense that I was like posting articles or things, but I would like write my thoughts about the market and write my thoughts about how to do deals. And it just got a lot of attention. And then I figured out that, so Facebook allowed you, when you have a group, to ask questions when people come into the group. And so I would say to people, you know, the first question was like, do you agree not to spam the group? The second was, I forget, something, maybe what are you interested in or who knows? And then the third one was like, if you would like my free download, give me your email address. So I was able to build up a list of several thousand people.
Oh, nice.
On that basis. And then the group was really, really effective because at the time it was really the only group on Facebook having real conversations about multifamily. So that was how I really grew like sort of my initial base of investors outside of my original kind of small group. And I did some partnering with other people too to bring in their investors. But that was really how I grew my list initially.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. And then those people that were on your list, are you sending a monthly newsletter? Are you doing webinars and other content? Are you just launching deals? How do you approach that?
Yeah, I mean, I've done a number of things. I mean, I have to say, like, I'm not the best with the list about being consistent. You know, I've done different things. I've had a daily email. I've had, you know, just posting when I have a deal. I do try to keep in touch with them as often as possible. So now I'm a little bit more organized about it. So I do send out a weekly, sort of newsletter of like interesting articles about the multifamily business that we find. You know, things like if there's any updates, I'll send them out, but I just want to make sure that they know I exist and I'm sending them some value every week. So that's been pretty good. I'm able to automate that with, you know, with my assistant. So she compiles the articles and sends them out. And that's a good way of just kind of keeping top of mind so that when I do have a deal, people haven't forgotten about me. Recently,
that's a lot of content.
Yeah. And then recently I've also been devoting a lot of energy to LinkedIn, which I find to be a really good platform. Facebook, unfortunately, a couple of years ago, they changed their algorithm and just so I had, like, in that Facebook group for a while, I'd been getting like 30 leads a day into that group, and it grew to about 12,000 people. Then they started changing their algorithms and nobody saw the group. I literally overnight went from 30 leads a day to 3 a week.
Wow.
And they just shut off the spigot. So after that, it just became a lot. Not only that, but I mean, even within the group, it stopped showing the posts to people. So I was doing a lot of posting and nobody was seeing it. So I wound up just kind of letting the group sort of wither because it just stopped being helpful. And then, you know, there was a proliferation of Facebook groups after that too about multifamily. So I wasn't the only game in town anymore. So that also hurt. So, yeah. But LinkedIn, I find very good.
Interesting. And today you're a fan, LinkedIn?
Yeah, today LinkedIn, I mean, you know, LinkedIn used to just be this sort of graveyard for resumes.
Right.
Now it's become a really good discussion forum.
It's migrated that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've got our, we've got an internal company group on LinkedIn that's, you know, pick your platform, you kind of do anything, but that was the one we chose to kind of share some internal, all kind of internal content, but that's been interesting. That's put me on LinkedIn more in general, yeah, kind of on the public side, but yeah, that's good. And we've done some marketing on there as well. Well, I want to switch gears, Jonathan, and talk about hotel stuff. I mean, you know, multifamily is great. We both have done a lot of that, and we talk about it all day. That's great. But I'm curious, you know, if this is a newer venture, what got you into it? What does that look like for you? And just kind of the whole thing around that.
Yeah. So this is not a business I expected to find myself in. And I think, like a lot of multifamily people, I was a little bit, well, not a little bit, definitely wary about the hotel space because I was like, oh my God, like if there's a recession, like nobody's going to come, you know, sure, it would be empty and it's going to, you know, be really, who wants that? Yep. But,
COVID, you know, with
COVID, for the space, everything, but even without COVID, just like, oh my God, what if the economy goes bad, like, and nobody shows up, you know? So what are we going to do? So what happened was during COVID, my wife and I bought a house in upstate New York in the place where we would always vacation. And in order to get to this house, we would always have to pass by this one particular hotel, which is in just this spectacular location. Like it has this commanding view of one of the lakes up there. It's like on top of the hill. You drive out of town and you hit the crest of the hill and you see this, you know, 30-mile-long lake laid out in front of you with this hotel right there at the top of it. And every time we drove by, we would have the same conversation. Man, somebody ought to do something about this crappy old hotel in this amazing location. You know, it's just such a shame. And so we were spending a lot of time up there, and I started thinking, like, boy, I'd like to be up here more. Maybe if I do some business up here, my wife will let me spend more time up here, right? So I started looking for multifamily assets up there and I couldn't find anything, but I came across that hotel for sale. And, you know, here I had been like for a year saying somebody ought to do something. I thought, well, maybe I'm the somebody who ought to do something about this. So I looked into it and, you know, knowing that I don't know anything about hotels, I thought, okay, well, I got to find somebody who knows something about hotels. So through a business partner, it turned out that, you know, one of his in-laws had a hotel management company, contacted him, you know, showed him the deal. What do you think? And he had just recently done several of these kind of very similar things like rehab, repositioning of an independent hotel. So he took a look and he's like, yeah, I think there's something here. And then because I was really wanted to be very conservative about this, I just went to one of my investors, actually one of the original guys, right? And said to him, hey, look, I've got this opportunity. Would you like to do this? Just the two of us. And so he said, yeah, he was interested. We actually did the whole deal for cash, including the rehab. You know, we finished.
No debt. Just
no debt at all. Right. Yeah. I mean, we probably wouldn't have even been able to get debt if we tried.
Yeah. Right. Is it but, like totally vacant? I mean, not functional?
Well, no, it was running. The problem is that the, you know, the way that, so I'll get into a minute of like why I really like this space, but you know, the way that people run these hotels is not the way that like you and I would run a multifamily property or even a hotel now. They're running them to make a tax loss, right? Okay. So they're paying themselves a salary, but they're not maximizing the value of the asset. They're making it look like it's losing money, so they don't have to pay taxes. And the problem with that is that when you take that to a bank, the bank goes like, "There's no cash flow. We're not financing this."
Yep.
Right. So these deals are not financeable. But that creates a lot of opportunity too. But anyway, so we rehabbed this first one. We got the rehab finished last year. Hotel's operating really well. What I noticed and why I suddenly became attracted to the space was because I realized a number of things. One is that these hotels, these independent hotels are owned mostly by mom and pops, right? Like I said, they run them in this way to like avoid paying taxes. Very often they haven't put any CapEx into them for a very long time.
Yep.
And they're now there's a big generational changeover where a lot of these owners, they're baby boomers or sometimes even older than that. This is like, if they want to retire, they have to sell this asset because all their net worth is tied up in it.
Yep.
And there are very few people who want to buy them because of the condition that they're in and because you can't finance them. So that for me, it's like, wow, there's a lot of, if you can find hotels that have a really good location, like the first one we did, it's like, well, wow, this is almost like a no-brainer if you can put the financing together because you've got this amazing location and you've got a really undervalued asset and it needs work. I can do that from my multifamily background. I know how to structure these deals. And then the other thing that's really interesting, so there's a lot of like, you can buy these assets at a really reasonable price. But then the other thing that's really interesting is that these owners, they use no tech. Right. They're running these things in a very antiquated fashion. And even if they're online, like you might be able to find them on Expedia, but you can't make a reservation online.
That's crazy.
Right. So they're leaving all this money on the table and they don't want to do it because, oh, it's too much trouble or whatever. Or they have all these weird ideas about hospitality from the old days. Like, oh, well, we might get overbooked and we always want to make sure we have a room available for somebody who drives up because we want them to know that there's always a room, right? And it's like, well, why wouldn't you book up every night if you could? Oh, no, you can't do that. So what we found is that even before you spend a dime of CapEx on these properties, you can increase the revenue by about 20% just by making it possible for people to reserve online.
I love that.
So with that hotel, the first, we took it over right before the high season started just by making it possible for people to sort of book online. We had the best month the hotel had ever had in its entire history before we spent any money on it. And then after we did the rehab that same month, the following summer, we doubled that revenue. So by, being able to charge higher room rates. What I noticed, I saw like, oh my God, there's this really, I think, big opportunity in this space to find these undervalued assets, modernize them, institute the tech that needs to be instituted, run them professionally, and you can create a lot of value. And then, you go from an asset where the buyer pool is really limited to an asset where now it's, stabilized, you can finance it, it's rehab, there's a much bigger buyer pool for that asset now. And there's even the possibility of putting a flag on it if you want to, which will make it even easier to sell and finance. So
yeah,
that's
brand on the hotel.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. I love all the low hanging fruit in there, and that sounds really cool. What did you guys end up doing with that one? Is it a long term hold for you? Did you end up selling it?
Yeah. So we're holding everything we buy. I mean, we did like I said, the first one. Completed the rehab in 2023. We closed on a second one in Vermont end of last year. We're almost done with the rehab on that one. And, we're just looking for more of these because I feel there's a lot of value there. I mean, there's obviously you got to roll up your sleeves and figure out how to finance them and you got to do all the work. But, we're pretty vertically integrated on this. We do the management in-house. We have our own work crew. So, and it's great because like unlike a multifamily, you know, where you've got to roll your rent roll in order to do your rehab. Like a hotel, it's going to be empty every night. It empties out. Yep. So you can just, we have our crew, they come and they live on site and they don't leave till they're done. So we can turn the whole thing around in 5-6 months and be ready to rock and roll, you know, in a pretty short time. And we have, you know, design team that we work with. They own the factory in China that, you know, we buy from. So it's a very smooth process. Yeah.
I feel like too, once you've kind of done like C-class multifamily, you know, other projects are like, yeah, it's going to be hard, but I mean, it's all relative.
Yeah.
That's not hard compared to what, you know, what you might've seen before. It's like, yeah, this is like easier in a lot of respects. Well, I want to talk to you a little bit kind of from your vantage point, having professional career, you know, a long commercial real estate career. We're talking in Q2 now, 2024. What are you seeing out there? What do you think is ahead for the next year, and how are you guys approaching that?
I mean, it's kind of a big question. So what I'm seeing out there, I mean, is I guess what everybody else is seeing. Not a lot of stuff. I'm not seeing a lot of stuff on the market.
Sure.
You know, there's kind of a trickle of deals. You know, whether it's multifamily or hotels, there's not a lot out there. And you know, in terms of like the debt and equity markets, I mean, LPs are definitely skittish right now. It's hard to raise money. And on the debt side, I mean, debt's expensive and I don't see that changing. Like I'm not in the camp of like, hey, rates are coming down. I don't think they're coming down anytime soon. I think we're kind of like in this until we work our way out of it. I don't think the Fed is coming to save us unless there's a recession, which will, you know, create a different problem, right? If we have a recession, then it's going to be hard to fill apartments, right? So I think, I think we're basically in this until incomes catch up, people can pay more rent, you kind of grow your way out of the problem at new higher cap rates and new higher interest rates. And because of that, I think I'm just sort of even more all in on the hotel space, because if you're doing like a deep value add, it almost doesn't really matter like what is going on with the economy, right? I mean, if you're buying something at a big discount and you're buying it based on where you are right now, so you're like, okay, the economy is not so great, but I'm buying it at a discount relative to where to the bad economy, like you're gonna be fine if you do that, right? So I kind of think in the hotel space, a lot the sellers are, you know, it definitely the market is a little bit slower than it was, but there's still like that generational turnover is happening. Like those people are retiring now. They're not waiting till the economy improves or interest rates come down to list their property. They're listing their property because they're like, I'm done. I've worked my last season at this. I don't want to be owning this hotel next year.
Yep.
So, you know, that's happening, you know? So I'm just looking for more of those kinds of opportunities.
Yeah. I like it. It's exciting when you find something that works, that is maybe a little off the beaten path, that you've got a proven path to make work. So that's awesome. Jonathan, well, I really appreciate your time. I love hearing your story. Thank you for sharing that with the audience here. If somebody listening wants to connect, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, connect with me on LinkedIn for sure is a great way. And if you want to go to my website, there's a free download there, which you can get. And that website is apartmentinvestorsclub.com. And there's a free checklist you can download there and also sign up for my email list. So that'd be the best place.
Awesome. We'll link to that in the show notes. If you're listening, you can scroll through and click through and visit Jonathan and the website there. Thank you so much. I appreciate it and wish you guys continued success. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Yep.
Thank you for listening to the DJE Podcast. For more information, please go to djetexas.com.